This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Sadie Shaw, artist and community advocate. Welcome, Sadie.
Thank you for having me.
Sadie, could you tell us about the Sugar Hill neighborhood and the Sugar Hill Oral History Project, for which you received an Arts Foundation grant?
Sugar Hill is one of Tucson's historic neighborhoods that was redlined specifically for Black homeowners in the early 1950s. And so the current boundaries of Sugar Hill are Stone, Grant, First Avenue, and Lee Street. Depending on who you're talking to, the boundaries of Sugar Hill have expanded and, you know, gotten smaller over the years. At one point, someone from the Oral History Project told me that it reached all the way to Speedway and as far west as Oracle Road. And so, you know, it's a neighborhood that's been through a lot of flux over the years. It's a neighborhood that my family calls home still. My grandpa moved to the neighborhood in the 1950s with his family from East St. Louis. Yeah, they bought a house on Stone and Ventura. The house is no longer there. At one point, I think in the early 80s, it was rezoned and it's now like an industrial area, but I still have some family in the neighborhood.
Could I ask you to explain this process of redlining for people who maybe are unfamiliar with the historical implications of this practice in our country?
So redlining is a thing that was done in Tucson and all over the country. They had, you know, a plot of land or a neighborhood that they redlined on the city plans for specifically Black homeowners. There's other places in Tucson that was specifically for Mexican Americans. But Sugar Hill was formerly a white neighborhood. And at some point in the late 40s, early 50s, they designated that area to be specifically for Black homeowners. And a lot of the families that moved there, like my family, came from out of state. There was a lot of people from Texas or Alabama who settled in the neighborhood. And also just local Black families. A lot of military families came to the neighborhood. At that point, they weren't allowed to stay on the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And so they had to settle elsewhere, and Sugar Hill was the place that they would call home. I got the idea for the Sugar Hill Oral History Project after I lost one of my family members, my cousin Antonio. Antonio was the keeper of the family history. He was the oldest grandchild in the family, and so he had seen pretty much everything. And, you know, he's my cousin, but he's like, if he was still around, he's in like his late 50s, he would be. And so, you know, he was around back in the day of Sugar Hill when it was, you know, still a very tight-knit community. And so he knew a lot about the family, things that I never knew. And he would, you know, always kind of have little tidbits to share. But yeah, we lost him around Christmas of 2017. And, you know, once he passed away, there was definitely like a hole that I felt, you know, spiritually, emotionally too, you know, losing him and losing all of that information that he held. It was hard. It was really hard. And, you know, I always wanted to kind of record his stories, but I never had the technology or, you know, the wherewithal to do that. And so once he passed, it was just kind of something that I really wanted to make happen, to record and to archive the stories of the historic residents of the neighborhood so I could keep something for them and preserve the neighborhood's general history through the stories of all the neighbors who many are still within the neighborhood, but a lot have moved out of the neighborhood. So yeah, I started it at the time I was a student at the University of Arizona. I reached out to the Special Collections Library Angus Anderson is conducting an oral history project for all of Tucson. You know, I reached out to him. I told him about my goals with the project. And he, you know, he shared his information with me. He signed off my for my paperwork for an internship with him. And he also loaned me his equipment so that I could conduct the oral history project in the neighborhood. Yeah, and from there, I guess it started in March of 2018 is when I started the first oral histories. I did about three or four, and those oral histories I showed at the Juneteenth Festival in 2018 at the TCC. I did a little installation upstairs where I kind of printed out sort of like a infographic of the different neighbors. And it was kind of like a self-serve thing where people would go up, pick a CD, put it in the player and sit down and just listen to people's stories. I mean, I'm still doing the project. At the Juneteenth that year, that was definitely the only place where I kind of physically showed it. Right now, I consider it to be a virtual installation. I have a SoundCloud account that I house all of the oral histories on. I think now there's about 18 hours of material that's always available for the public to click on. And you could see the pictures of the people who are talking through that website.
That's wonderful. We will be sure to include a link to it at kxci.org. Sadie, could you tell us maybe one of your favorite stories or just a story that's outstanding in your mind from the Sugar Hill Oral History Project?
My favorite story from the project was told to me by Dr. Bobby Morrison, who shared a lot of the stories that his mother, Ethel Morrison, used to tell him. Ethel worked as a maid in Tucson. She worked for a lot of well-to-do families in the community. One of those includes the Levitts family, Sam Levitts and his family. But the story that really stuck with me was told to him by his mom, who also worked for a Swedish woman. And she and her family came to America. And so when they came to America, they arrived first on Ellis Island. Her family was told by an immigration official right upon arrival that they were not to speak or make friends with any African Americans. And I think that kind of speaks to institutional racism, you know, and how it's embedded in, you know, not only the psyche of people who are born here, but is passed along into white immigrants' state of mind, being told by an immigration official specifically not to speak to anyone who is African American, you know, and also saying that there could be consequences if they did that. Just shows how deep systematic racism is in this country.
And it points to a very important intersectionality between the violence of the immigration system and the violence of other systems, for example, the legal system and the police system, and how we have definitely these important points of intersection to explore when it comes to the rights of immigrants and the rights of Black people and people of color in the United States.
Absolutely.
Gentrification is a part of the Sugar Hill neighborhood story. It's a part of Tucson. Often, I think gentrification is hard to talk about. It's kind of slippery because there doesn't seem to be a perpetrator. It's kind of just a natural result of capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really important to remember that that's how the status quo works, right? And that there have to be interventions into that status quo in order to right the wrong trajectory that these systems were built on to begin with. You and I talked about a really interesting type of intervention, a land trust. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Community land trusts are kind of avenues for communities, neighborhoods, or just groups of people to kind of tap into to acquire land and to keep it held in the hands of not just one person, but just the community at large. The first land trust in America happened in Georgia by Black sharecroppers. And, you know, they were looking for a way to own the land that they worked. And so they formed a community land trust with a group of people. I think it was around 20. And that's kind of where I got the idea, learning about land trusts, about their model of land trusts, and seeing if Sugar Hill can apply it in the neighborhood to kind of buy back the land for the community, specifically the historic residents who have largely been kind of pushed out of the neighborhood through the effects of gentrification. Sugar Hill definitely has kind of a interesting history about how Black people moved in the 50s. It was, you know, an up-and-coming community. It was very tight-knit. But then around a certain time period, I would say the early 80s is when things started to change. There was an uptick in crime. The war on drugs was happening. And, you know, there was a lot of divestment in the community. And of course, after that happened, a lot of people were selling their homes. And so other people started moving into the neighborhood. A lot of developers came and bought up some of the houses. Sometimes they bought up a whole streets of houses and would demolish those historic homes and in their place put up student condominiums. And that's kind of what you see nowadays. A lot of the historic residents have left. We still have, you know, about 10% Black neighbors in Sugar Hill, but there are definitely a lot of new people. There's a lot of students living in the neighborhood now. There's also a lot of empty student homes. One of the developers in town, Michael Goodman, has a lot of properties in the neighborhood that used to be rented very frequently. And nowadays, with the new high rises, we're seeing that a lot of those houses are remaining empty. And yet, they're only catering to the student population. They don't look for renters who don't kind of fit that status of student. And so it's definitely an issue because it has, you know, the gentrification process has increased the price of the homes in the area. It increased the price of renting a home. And typically, if you're looking to rent a home in Sugar Hill, you'll notice that many of the homes are rented out per bedroom. A lot of the times it's like 700 or more per bedroom. And so that kind of keeps out a lot of people, especially the historic residents who want to move back into the neighborhood. They're not able to because most of the houses are catered towards a specific population, like students who might move in with a group of friends.
And who can afford $700 per bedroom?
Right, right. And so, yeah, I got the idea for a community land trust, you know, while doing research and seeing that, you know, there is a community land trust program in Tucson. It's called the Pima County Community Land Trust. But I wanted more of a neighborhood-focused sort of land trust where it was developed by community members who are from the neighborhood who want to kind of create a renaissance of sorts back in the community. And so, yeah, we're forming a land trust as I speak. We're actually looking for people to join the executive committee of it. We're getting a lot of help from, you know, a lot of different community members. We met with former Mayor Jonathan Rothschild, who gave us some advice about it. We're speaking with Betty Villegas, who's also offering her help. And we're just, you know, kind of bringing back a lot of the people in the neighborhood who have left but still want to be involved, who still want to kind of recreate what Sugar Hill was in the past. So we're hopeful that, you know, we're going to acquire land somehow. Of course, you know, buying land takes capital, which we do not have. And so we're looking into all kinds of ways to form this. You know, our main goal is to have one day low-income housing, or maybe completely free housing in the neighborhood. But right now, we also want to focus on creating a farm and a grocery store, because Sugar Hill, although, you know, it's sort of across the street from the Fry's grocery store, historically, Sugar Hill did have little independently owned grocery stores in the neighborhood. And so we want to bring that back and have fresh food grown in the neighborhood by neighbors to be readily available. And not just Sugar Hill, but the neighborhoods that surround it, like Ocotillo Oracle, Barrio Blue Moon.
Wow, that sounds like an amazing project. And we do have some of these historical small corner stores operating in certain neighborhoods. You know, I think it would be a really amazing to bring that back, especially now that everybody has had a little taste of food insecurity through the pandemic. It just kind of brings everything into a sharper focus. Sadie, you're currently running for TUSD board, a move that is very in line with your interest in political art, advocacy, and community. Could you talk about your decision to run for this position during a global pandemic and describe to us what running a campaign these days looks like?
So yeah, running for the TUSD school board seems like a natural progression for me from like my work in the neighborhood, but I didn't come to that decision on my own. I was actually asked by a community member, Pastor Grady Scott, who had seen me speak on a panel for the Issues in Eggs breakfast for the League of Women Voters, you know, and he approached me after I spoke on the panel and asked me if I was interested in running for school board, you know, and it definitely was not on my radar at all. But I do have a child in the district. My daughter, Salome, is a second grader at Monzo Elementary. And so, you know, I considered it, and it definitely, you know, being in a pandemic, it was a hard decision because it's already so difficult as it is with everything that's going on. But I did some research on TUSD, on the board, and I just, like Pastor Grady Scott said, there was a huge lack in diversity historically from the TUSD school board. And so I decided to run to kind of be a voice for the majority of the students in the district who don't have a lot of representation in the TUSD leadership. Yeah, running a campaign in the pandemic is a lot different than you typically would see. Unfortunately, I'm not able to go door to door like I like to. So we're doing a lot of things virtually. And, you know, I just turned in my signatures. We have a lot of things planned for the next few months, virtual events, virtual town halls, forums. As much as I'm not able to physically approach people, I do want to try to do some outreach, like old school outreach, like, you know, canvassing, dropping things off in people's doors and not like, you know, physically speaking to them. Knocking on their door and like, you know, kind of taking a step back and speaking to them at a distance. That's all things that we are considering and we hope to do as we move toward November. But yeah, it's a lot different, but I wanted to do it because, you know, there's only been one African American person on the school board since it was created, Miss Gloria Copeland, who served in the late 90s. On the campaign trail, I'm learning more about the district than, you know, I ever thought I would know. You know, it's actually connected a lot with the Oral History Project because, you know, a lot of people know about the desegregation case that TUSD has been under since the 70s. And yeah, I discovered through research that some of the first schools that they closed down because of the whole desegregation case was the Black schools that the kids of Sugar Hill went to. Those schools were University Heights and Roosevelt. Elementary. And a lot of people, you know, obviously haven't heard of those schools now because they were closed in the 70s. But yeah, if you listen to my oral histories, all of those people went to those elementary schools. And the other school that they closed down was John Spring Middle School, which is, you know, was once Dunbar. And yeah, my dad went to that school before they closed it down. And so, you know, it's really kind of sad to hear that, because those students who went there, you know, they had nothing but good things to say about those schools. And of course, they were racially concentrated schools. The Fishers, who kind of started the class action lawsuit, one of their main concerns was that the racially concentrated schools in the district were receiving poor curriculum. They had limited resources given to them. And, you know, I think it's really unfortunate that the district decided to just close down those schools instead of trying to lift them up and give them more resources.
Wow, it is pretty impressive to hear you talk about basically having somebody come to you with this idea of, hey, would you like to run for TUSD school board during a global pandemic? and you just saying, yeah, I think that's something that I should do for the community. And that's really inspirational. Thank you for sharing that. Sadie, could you talk to us about your art? It seems like your artistic trajectory has really taken you in this political direction. And I wonder what, you know, kind of what your artistic trajectory has been and what your thoughts about art and politics together are.
My, I guess, career as an artist has definitely changed a lot over the years. I mean, I was an art student for a long time. I started at Pima, and there I was focusing mainly on printmaking and painting. But then I moved to the university. You know, everything kind of changed there. I took a contemporary art class and learned about installation and performance art. And from there, I started to explore those mediums. But I didn't really get into political art until about 2 years ago, probably the same time, around the time when my cousin passed away. I guess the first political art piece I did was in response to a flyer that I found posted at the U of A on one of their public art pieces, the large sculpture, the border wall by the Marshall Building. And I was going to class one day and I saw stuck on the sculpture these words that said, "White supremacy is a myth that only fools believe." And of course, I removed it. I took a picture and then I removed it. But I searched those words online and I found that it was like white supremacist propaganda that was kind of popping up all over the country. And, you know, the words are really kind of tricky in their verbiage, because a lot of people didn't understand how that was a white supremacist thing. But, you know, doing research, I did find that it was the starting point for people to kind of become emboldened and maybe join a white supremacist group. And so in response to that, I painted a large banner. It was about 4 feet by 7 feet. And I painted "End White Supremacy," and I hung it up in the middle of that sculpture and left it there for about a day. And so, yeah, I think that artists in times like this, where there's a lot of social unrest, I think artists have a duty to create work that speaks to the times that they live in. I think artists should respond to, you know, the terrible things that are happening. I definitely can't create like a still life of flowers or just a picture that is nice to look at in times where people are being killed in the streets. And so I think that's where art is so powerful, in that it can kind of cause social change. You know, if you look at Picasso's Guernica painting, I mean, that was huge in kind of changing people's thoughts on atrocities of war. And so I think it's the duty of every artist to create artworks that will push people to kind of open their eyes and think differently about things that might be happening, things that they may not understand completely. Art is powerful. And so like another artwork that I made soon after that was called Negrophobia. And Negrophobia is an installation that I showed first at the Steinfeld Warehouse downstairs in Subspace. And so that installation details the killings of 30 unarmed African Americans by police from 2015 to 2017. And so it's definitely a very heavy installation. You walk downstairs and the lighting's low and you see these targets, shooting targets that are lined up kind of in a rectangular shape, just with string. So it's almost like they're floating. And on each of those targets, I have the picture of a person who was killed by the police. And then bullet holes that reflect where they were shot and their name, and then the officer's name who shot them. And then on the floor was more info on each of the targets. So there were 30 pieces of paper lying on the ground, kind of an in-depth look at what happened to them, as well as 30 chalk outlines on the ground. All that information kind of coupled with the music that was playing in the background, Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday. It was definitely my most powerful art piece as of yet. And you know, it's ongoing. I still have more targets. I'm still documenting the cases of different people that were shot and killed. And so, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that art piece is ever gonna kind of stop growing, at least until, you know, something changes in this country.
I often think that art has a power of protest that nothing else has, because words alone can be co-opted by the other side and distorted, and justifications can be made. But when things are laid out in that kind of a visual, visceral way, they become a lot harder to argue with or co-opt. So I really do believe in the power of protest art and political art. Is there a message that you would like to share specifically with Tucson African American youth right now?
I'm just, I guess, at the end of my youthhood. And now I see there's a lot more ways to get involved. There's a lot more groups and organizations that are organizing, not just around Black-centered issues, but issues that affect all people. And so I would just encourage the youth to get involved, to reach out to people, and to take risks. Because I think risk-taking is, although scary, it leads to change. You know what I mean? I definitely have taken some risks in my life, and all of those things kind of led me to where I am. I never thought that I was a leader at all up until, you know, the fact that I was kind of the only person at the Sugar Hill meeting where I was elected to be president of the neighborhood. I was really afraid, feeling like I was unqualified, just kind of jumped at the opportunity. And I learned as I went. And so, yeah, if I hadn't taken that risk, I definitely would not be running for school board at this point. And absolutely, that is another enormous risk that I'm taking. But, you know, if you do it for the community, if you have good intentions, even if you fail, then that risk is not in vain, because you might embolden someone else to do something similar, or to take an opportunity that they might be fearful for pursuing. Get out there, take risks, join groups, or even form your own group if you don't see that anywhere in the community. You know, definitely voting is important. Get out and vote. Get your friends out to vote. Yeah, just be the change that you want to see, you know, and we all kind of start somewhere. We all make mistakes, and we all we all learn as we go. And so a lot of youth think that they might not be ready for taking that next step. But, you know, you're never ready until you're like through the door. Yeah, do everything that you can and don't be afraid to do something new.
I think that is such great advice. I think that for young people or anybody who's kind of emergent in a new scene or in a new field, it kind of can feel like, oh, leaders are really just, you know, the top notch. They must be the cream of the crop, right? And often that's not necessarily the case, right? Like, they may or may not be. And I think that the more people spend time in leadership and find themselves sitting at these tables, you know, and Michelle Obama talks about this in her book, actually, you find, wait a minute, the smartest person in the room is not necessarily the leader. You know, I think that in the United States, especially, we have a big like hero culture where we celebrate superheroes and we really put certain class or category of people on a pedestal. But I think you're totally right. If you have a sincere desire to serve the community, if you have a servant's heart, you need to get out there and lead and get as involved as you can, because obviously that's what we need right now. We need people who care and who are going to act like it. And if we can get that, we're going to be so much better off.
Absolutely. You know, if anyone's looking to join or volunteer, you know, there's a lot of groups that you can reach out to. Of course, Black Lives Matter Tucson is doing a lot of work in the city, and their Facebook is a place where, you know, you can see what's happening with them and find places to get involved. There's also the NAACP chapter, and I think they have a youth subchapter. The Tucson Urban League is also another organization that has a chapter for young people, the Tucson Urban League Young Professional Group. Other people like Blacks Friday, which is kind of spearheading the Black business website. There's so many things. Black Renaissance does so much with events. And, you know, there's still a lot of opportunities to create something new, to create something that we don't have yet in Tucson. And so, you know, I'm excited to see how the community is growing. And I know that the momentum is not going to stop in Tucson for the Black community.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
You know, I'm on this new journey with running for TUSD school board. So I invite anyone who's listening to check out my website, Shaw4TUSD.com. You could find out about my platform there and see how you can volunteer or donate to my campaign. Get your friends out there to vote on November 3rd.
Thank you so much, Sadie.
Thank you, Ava.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. Support for Artist Stories is provided by Benjamin Supply, presenting a full spectrum of hardware and plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath, and their gallery, Tucson, offering national and local art in both the Tucson Warehouse and Transfer Buildings on 6th Street and 7th Avenue. With products available at will call, they are currently open by phone at 777-7000 and at benjaminsupply.com or gallerytucson.com.